Success stories and interviews with game changers and thought leaders who have overcome both in life and in business. Welcome to Vertical Momentum.
Hey guys, it's me. Welcome back to VM. Welcome back, Vertical Momentum. Welcome back, guys. You know how I feel about September 11th. You know how it changed my life and changed my perspective on everything. But we're going to be talking about that 9/11 is still claiming lives every single day. And we're going to be talking about that with my friend Eric. But first, I want to thank our sponsors. Without you guys, we wouldn't be able to do what we do. If you guys love woodworking, our friends at Balish Woodworks make some of the best handmade woodworking for your home. Now, just a hint, guys, you know, Valentine's Day is coming up. Maybe you want to get something made for your wife. For Mother's Day, I got my wife. They made her a cutting board. It's the only thing she will use. And they actually etched our family name into it. So that's maybe a good idea to check them out at Balish Woodworks. Now, and then also Tammy Moses from The Hoarding Solution. You know, a lot of people think hoarding is, you know, it's just a... could be a mental thing. A lot of it's a physical thing, but a lot of people don't realize how many first responders and firefighters get killed because of people that have hoarding issues and they can't get out of the homes. So definitely reach out to Tammy Moses if you know anybody living in the hoard, because maybe it might save you, but it might also save the first responder going in to help that person. All right, guys, thank you so much. Like I said, we're going to be talking about some heavy stuff today with my friend Eric, and he's changing the game, and I can't wait to see what we do together in the future. Eric, my friend, how are you doing today?
Very good. Very good. Grateful to be here.
So what's going on? How is your day going?
Going good so far. Been out talking with our sponsors and our future podcast guests that we're going to be having on very soon. We're currently in the Nashville area with the 9/11 Remembered Let's Roll podcast tour bus, which I'm sitting in right now. So got some great stuff coming up around the corner, and look forward to telling you all about what we have going on.
Yep. So talk to us. You know, for me, I always like to know, to get to know the person, you know, behind the camera. So talk to us about where you're from, where you grew up, and what kind of little boy was Eric?
So I was actually born in Worcester, Massachusetts, but I never actually lived there until 2011. I grew up virtually entirely in California, raised and educated there. I was involved with fire department and EMS pretty much since college and beyond in my personal life and professional life. I left California in 2011 and relocated to Massachusetts, where I was actually born, and spent time with my extended family, which is 99% still there in the Massachusetts area. And pretty much been working full time with our foundation and our massive project with the 9/11 Traveling Memorial and Podcast Tour.
Now, did you always find a fascination with fire department and having a heart of service? Was that something that was always ingrained in you?
Well, my father was in the Marine Corps, and as a tiny kid, I was one of the kids that had the radio flyer tricycle with the hook and ladder cart behind it. And, you know, that was always a part of my life. And my father was very, very big into showing me as I grew up about American exceptionalism, people who we honor, why we honor them. A strange thing that my father used to do is take me to cemeteries and show me famous people in cemeteries or relatives of ours and things like that. So there's always been a part of my life that was basically connected to what would be considered service, or, you know, being a person that serves your community in some way, shape, or form.
Now, what year did you go through the academy?
Are you saying the fire academy?
Yep.
Well, I started working with the fire department in college in California, and that was the beginning of it. So you enter the academy, we'll say around 1984. And as I moved throughout different places in California, I was always involved with fire departments, whether it was on a direct level or a volunteer level. I had my own search and rescue business in California, which is how I became involved with search dogs and cadaver dogs. So it's always been a continuous part of my life, I would say probably since the early 80s.
Now, you know, I've talked to a lot of police officers. I've talked to a lot of military, a lot of corrections officers, but I've never really had the honor of talking to a firefighter. So I just want to say thank you. Talk to what going through the Firefighter Academy is like, because it seems like, I mean, I know it's, you know, like me and my wife, we're hooked on that show 911. And it seems like you guys have to go through so many different scenarios. And it seems like, how do you guys figure all that out? So what was your academy experience like?
Well, a lot of it actually depends on where specifically you are and what type of fire department you could be involved with. So you could be in a metropolitan fire academy. You could be in a fire academy that could be associated with, say, the Forest Service or forest firefighting. But you go through all of the basic skill sets that you would need to have to be an operator of any of the equipment, apparatus, and first aid skills, advanced first aid skills. So just depending on where you actually probably sit within in your future career in the fire department, that's kind of how your training goes. A lot of the academies are actually linked nationally. So there's national standards and things that you go through to become a firefighter. You always have continuing education, continuing training. So you could be doing high, low angle rope rescue training. You can be doing confined space training. You can be doing hazmat training. All of this stuff is always ongoing and continuous. So it's always a part of your life. It's not just the academy. It's a continuous education throughout your entire time within agencies like that.
No, and that's, you know,
as well.
You know, I have a lot of friends that are police officers and first responders, and a lot of them, like military, you know, there's that thin blue line, thin green line. I'm sure there's a thin red line where, you know, like in the military, we couldn't tell our families what we saw over there or what we did, just because it would probably scar them for life. But we always had our brothers to talk to. Now, is that the same thing in your job? Is that something that you guys find that you can always open up to another firefighter where you can't really open up to your own family?
You know, that's actually a really great question, because a lot of the people that I actually work with right now, some of the foundations that we're involved with are counseling foundations that deal with first responders and veterans. And one of the main questions I get asked all the time is, why is it so hard for a first responder to come out and talk about suicide or PTSD and those types of things versus the military? And my personal experience is that, you know, way, way, way back when I started, you were damaged goods within a police department or a fire department if you came out and started talking about this kind of stuff. You could be, you know, pretty much eliminated from something that you've spent your whole life trying to get into if you were considered damaged goods. When it came to the military side of PTSD and suicide, it was already out there. It was already a thing that was talked about. But because you know, you go into the military service and then you're done and you're a veteran and you have all these support groups there, it really wasn't there in formal EMS stuff with police and fire. You had opportunities to get some counseling if it was a mega disaster or something like that. But for the most part, it's always been a very touchy subject. And I think it's prevented a lot of people from being able to get help they need. So that's one of the reasons that we focus on that now in the work that we do, is to make sure. And I fully admit, it wasn't until my involvement in 9/11, I wasn't really a huge believer in the total story of PTSD until it just basically walked up and smacked me in the face. So, you know, I regret that that was a part of my mentality of it years ago, but I'm definitely on the other side of the coin now.
Now, like a lot of people don't know, and this is going to go out everywhere, obviously it's going to be, but a lot of people don't know that the average American male, average lifespan is 78 years old. But the average lifespan for a first responder, police officer, firefighter is about 59. So there's a 19-year difference. That's a big difference.
Yeah.
What is it? What do you think that the reason why so many first responders pass away early?
Well, I don't know. That's a hard question. I think, you know, there's obviously stuff that could just be naturally part of a person's health and physical constitution that is the reason for that. But, you know, it's probably a hard to define reason why that might be. Particularly, I don't know if I could actually put a finger on that. I do know that, you know, you're always being pushed to your physical limit within a fire department or a police department or a rescue type service, EMS. So it just might be an endurance thing. You know, you only have, there's people that say that you're born with so many heartbeats the minute you're born. And when you hit the last one, that's the last one. So, you know, who knows what it is. Maybe there's some natural way that people that go into the military and EMS somehow naturally divide themselves into that life expectancy bracket. I don't know. So okay. It's a great question.
Now, take us back to your experience on that Tuesday morning, because for me, I can just close my eyes and it brings me right back to sitting on that couch, crying and being a broken man. What was your experience like that Tuesday morning?
Well, that particular morning, I was actually working at an emergency room up where I used to live in California. And we were an hour away from what would be considered a major city. So we were in that, what's known as the golden hour zone, in a emergency room up in the Sierra Nevada mountains. So I arrived at work that day to see several people in the waiting room who were standing in front of the television set, just crying. And so my first obvious question was, what's going on? And they point out, you know, to the television, and right at the moment I looked up, the second plane was just hitting the towers. And I stood there in complete shock, just like everybody else. I just couldn't believe what I was seeing. And the one thing that actually did catch my eye was the bottom of the screen had the crawl going. And it might have been that Turner Broadcasting or Headlines. I don't even remember what it was back then, but there was very few 24-hour news agencies at the time. So on the bottom of the screen, there was an 800 number that said, you know, we need rescue workers, we need help, we need doctors, we need dogs, we need all of this. And there's this 800 number. So I wrote the 800 number down and I ran to my office, which was, you know, just past the emergency room. I actually ran so fast, my shoes came off, but I left them in the hallway and I made it to my office and I called that 800 number because I was fully trained and ready to go. I had a cadaver dog that was ready to go in search and rescue. And when I called that number, I got through on the very first try. I was so shocked that had happened. I was actually a little bit taken back because, you know, I wasn't even sure who I was talking to, but I was talking to Emergency Services of New York City, and they were actually fielding the calls for that 800 number. And I explained who I was, what my capabilities were, that I had a dog, and we were ready to assist in any way we can. And they said, look, you know, we don't know how you're going to get here. We know flights are being grounded. I wasn't even sure right at that moment if they were completely done, but I know a lot of air travel was just basically vaporizing everywhere. And so I said, don't worry about it. I'll be in a vehicle heading your way shortly. And it was only, you know, a short time later, the same day, that I was on my way via Interstate 80, driving across the United States to New York City. And I was told to go to the Javits Center, which is the convention center in downtown New York City. And that's where I was supposed to rendezvous with the people that I have been speaking with on the phone. So, you know, that began the journey from California all the way out to New York City. Arrived there, it was Tuesday that this happened. So I arrived there late Thursday afternoon. I brought another firefighter with me that I had had as a colleague at the time. So we team drove across the United States. And, you know, a lot of crazy things actually happen on the way, which I can, you know, tell you about later on in our discussion. But we just come over a rise, and we can actually see lower Manhattan. We can see the smoke billowing up from the towers. And we, you know, at this time too, there was no GPS, there was no nothing like that. We didn't have a Thomas guide of New York or anything like that. We just knew, you know, we basically had a AAA map with a yellow highlighted line across it on where we're technically supposed to be driving. So we're just going over the George Washington Bridge, and we didn't know if we were going to go right or left or whatever we were going to do. And then right at that moment, NYFD vehicle came past us that said like animal control or something on it. I was a little even surprised by that. And I just said to my partner, I said, hey, whatever we do, stay 6 inches off the bumper of that vehicle. They're probably heading down, you know, to the location here. And sure enough, they did. We hopped on 9A and we went right down the Hudson. And then I just happened to look to my left and there's the Javits Center. Oh my God, there it is. That's where we're supposed to be. And so I pulled up around the opposite side of where we had first seen the Javits Center. Places surrounded by hundreds of state troopers, military people with machine guns, and these massive cordoned off protection zone. And I walked up to a state trooper and I said, hey, I was, you know, asked to come here from California. I've got my dog. I'm supposed to go inside and register. And the state trooper's last name was Wonka, like Willy Wonka. It was a female state trooper, New York state trooper. So she escorted me and my dog Porkchop into the building. And we were taken to a table that had actually FEMA was at the table. Doing the registering and accounting of people that were coming in to become volunteers. So she introduced me to the person at the table with FEMA. It said that I had just got here from California, had my dog with me. The guy's looking right at me. And his exact words out of his mouth were, get in your effing vehicle and go home. I don't need you. And I'm like, whoa. You know, and I go, wait. You just heard we just came from California. We got a dog. We're ready to go. He goes, no, get in your effing car and go home. I'm not going to register you. We don't need you. At that point, I was ready to go over the table and just destroy this guy. State trooper grabs him by the arm. We go outside and I just go, you know, what was that all about? And she's like, I have no idea what this guy's story is. So I said, well, I need to go find a place to stay. I got to regroup. I got to figure out, you know, what's going on here. So she tells me to go over to the Times Square Marriott, which is where apparently she said FEMA had the entire hotel, or a vast majority of the rest of the rooms were being assigned to FEMA personnel coming from all across the United States. So we went there, and I got registered under my own name, under my own search and rescue business name. I wasn't deployed there as a firefighter from my hometown. I was actually there as a private, dog handler with my own search and rescue business. And they gave us a room, and I got all the gear up there, got my dog up there. And I actually kind of needed a drink at that moment. So I went down to the fourth floor of the Times Square Marriott is where all the restaurants and bars are. So I'm sitting at this bar with my dog, and there's a guy across the bar who kind of kept giving me the stink eye. And I wasn't sure if he was pissed that I had the dog or what the deal was, but every time somebody got up in between myself and him, he would move a little bit closer and a little bit closer. And he finally gets right up next to me, and he goes, "Hey man," he goes, "what are you doing here?" And I'm like, "Oh shit, you know," and I got to explain to this guy what's going on. And I told him the story that I just told you, and this guy, he turned like red, almost purple with anger. He was so mad after hearing that story. He reaches into his suit. He's a three-piece suit guy, pulls out a business card. He's like the assistant director of emergency communications for New York City. And he goes, "You meet me on a street corner tomorrow morning at 5 a.m. He goes, "You'll be on the pile 5 minutes later." I'm like, "All right." So sure enough, he was exactly where he said he was going to be. We met him. He escorted us to a place where the ID badges were being made. And when we got there, it was like a easy up canopy kind of tent situation. There probably was 1,000 people in line trying to get in. And most of them looked like steel workers, Carhartt coveralls, you know, the hard hats, the whole deal. This guy walks us to the front of the line and he says, "I need two IDs right now for these two guys." And the guy gives him a little pushback, and he loses his shit again. He says, "Give him an effing ID right now." And no problem. Boom, boom, boom. Two IDs came out. I was assigned to NYPD K-9 unit, which was operating out of a high school right around the corner from the pile. And so we went down, got our vehicle in a place where we were allowed to park, because we're inside of a cordoned off area now. And I was taken to the NYPD K-9 temporary, rally point, and we registered in, and literally 15 minutes later, I turned the corner and it all unfolded from there.
So, you know, a lot of people have seen it, you know, the footage, but what was actually seeing the pile and knowing that 343 of your brothers were in there? And well, I mean, we didn't know how many at that time.
Yeah, nobody knew. I mean, 2,977 people were killed that day. And of course, the unknown amount of civilians that were in the building was a huge factor. And obviously, so many, emergency personnel, fire department, port authority. One thing that actually, before I ever turned that corner and saw the pile for the first time, and this is just a couple of days later, the smell of death was so strong in the air already. It was already, it made the hair on my arm stand up the minute I got out of my vehicle, and boom, you're hit with this very distinct odor. We like I said, we got registered, and we were basically sent out. The guy goes, "Look," he goes, "just go do what you do. There's none of our guys that you need to team up with. Just take your dog and go do what you're supposed to do." And so, I turned the corner, and the whole drive out to New York was, we're going to find somebody in a pocket, or we're going to have a part of the building that's actually in, because we don't know. We haven't seen anything really, except for what showed up on a newspaper front page. There's very little being broadcast of the actual pile. And the second I did turn that corner and see it, I lost all hope. I lost immediately, just knew that there was, if somebody had not already been found in the first couple of days before I got there, there was no way somebody was in this pile, which was still on fire, 2,000 to 3,000 degree fire burning fuel. You can smell jet fuel. You can smell diesel fuel. It was just a horrific deal. There was no training that you could ever go through to just have something like that just hit you like that. It was bad. It was very, very bad situation.
So what was Pork Chop's reaction? Because, you know, we know about their heightened smell and all that. So yep. What was his reaction?
So I had turned the corner, and just out in front of me, there was a battalion chief standing there all by himself. And there was like a patch of ground that looked like fresh asphalt just before it gets steamrolled. It's called fresh mat. And he's standing on this patch of ground that has no debris on it. There's nothing from the building there. So I walk up to him and I introduce myself and I said, "Hey, can you just give me a sense of where you guys need me? Or do you want to pair me up with somebody? I mean, just kind of give me a roundabout idea of what's going on." And he says, "Well, this is actually the only officially cleared piece of ground right now, you know, that we have, that we're standing on." And while I'm talking to him, my dog was actually giving the commands that he's supposed to give, that he has located something. But I imagine that I was still in a little bit of a shock kind of situation of still taking in this whole thing. And I'm looking down at Pork Chop and I'm saying, you know, quiet, you know, but he's actually pawing at the ground and he's doing what he's supposed to do. And it wasn't until I realized that he was telling me this, only having just been told that this is cleared ground. And it's, you know, there's nothing here that we should be looking for. We should be over here at the pile kind of a deal. I look down and I see a little tiny shimmer of what looked like gold to me. So I get down on my hands and knees, and sure enough, it's a wedding band. The wedding band was actually on a finger. And within moments, with my trowel, I had uncovered a considerably large human remain. And that's within my first 45 minutes of being there. That's how it started. And it never changed from that moment on. It was constantly finding stuff like that nonstop.
Now, did you ever find anybody that was alive?
Never found anybody alive. And to be perfectly honest about it, I never saw a completely whole person the entire time I was there.
Now, like I said, I have my cousin actually went down there, and he was one of the construction workers that they let go there. And he would say, you know, he would work 18, 24 hours, you know, as much as he can. And yeah. There was guys that were staying there, police officers, firefighters, construction workers. They didn't want to go home. They wanted to, you know.
There were people that were sleeping right there. In the buildings that had the windows blown out, you know, and they were just sleeping on the ground inside. They had set up cots and little, you know, almost like they looked like people were camping at the landfill is really the best way to describe it. It was a pretty bad deal. I mean, I can't even describe how lucky I was to be able to actually have a place to go back to and shower and switch gear and have clean gear. We were doing those long shifts, but, you know, I had this place secured, you know, that we could go and take the dog to and stuff like that. My very first day there, Pork Chop was actually attacked by a police dog that had broken its lead and had grabbed him and viciously was just tearing at him, trying to kill him, basically. We got taken to a veterinary mass unit, which was set up just on the edge of the perimeter of the security cordon. And he got checked out there. And that's where this photo that ended up on the cover of every newspaper in the world the next day, somebody had snapped a picture of basically Pork Chop getting looked at this place, and that opened up another whole scenario, crazy scenario for us. But yeah, it was
a lot of guys said that it was loud, but then it was quiet. And so talk to us about, you know, because a lot of people, if they've never been, you know, in any kind of scenario like that, or any kind of war or anything, that sometimes when the shit hits the fan is when things actually get really still and quiet. So what was that like?
Well, even when we arrived there, it was still an extremely chaotic situation. I mean, they had just barely gotten the parts of the cranes moved in, and they were trying to establish, you know, foundations for these massive cranes to set up on. There was end dump trucks, high side dump trucks for miles down 9A, just waiting in line to come in and receive debris that was supposed to be taken out of there. And the another thing, and there's pictures out now of it, but you know, there were thousands of people there with 5-gallon buckets in their hands, picking up one piece of paper at a time, one, you know, piece of metal, whatever it was that you could physically pick up. I mean, it was, you know, it was like pixie sticks, you know, and that was the only way. And there was people standing in lines, like 200 people in a, they looked like arms of an octopus coming off the pile, and they would be handing these buckets to each other, and fresh buckets would be going in. And that's how the early days of 9/11 began, on trying to get into these places where people thought there might've been pockets and stuff, you know, but that's where the fire was. That's where all the chemical smells were coming from. The everything bad was happening where everybody was standing and trying to, you know, basically claw their way into. But these quiet moments, I very distinctly remember there was one day where we were there, and it might have been even the first 3 or 4 days we were there. We were on top of the pile. I had pork chop, and I had met other people who were in my exact same position, who had gotten there with their dogs, independent dog handlers, who were basically shunned or set aside. And we all ended up forming our own task force team. So I was part of 4 or 5 other guys that had dogs, and we went and we met every day from that point forward and went out and did the work that we did. But so we're on the pile, and there's no flights, and we know that there's no aircraft flying around the United States. There was every now and again, we'd hear a helicopter go by, but there was this one particular moment where we just heard the loudest drone of like prop airplane engines, and the whole place went quiet as a mouse, and everybody looked up in the sky, and there was this fixed wing aircraft that was going so slow, you know, right above us. And we later found out it was some sort of reconnaissance filming plane that was trying to get a picture. But that brought the place to a standstill, because the minute you hear that, you're thinking, oh shit, here comes another airplane. You know, I mean, nobody knew what was going on. That moments like that, if we had come across a firefighter or a police officer's remains, everything came to a screeching halt. All work stopped in a very incredible procession was formed to remove that person and bring him out in a flag covered situation and get him into an ambulance and taken away. So there were moments like that that were very emotional, very big moments that were happening down there, as far as things just going silent. And then the sound of bagpipes would start, which is another crazy thing to remember. And the minute something like that happened, there was bagpipes playing. So very interesting how all of that kind of came to be.
Now, a lot of times, like, they'll show a lot of pictures of like the lines you were talking about. And if you look really closely, maybe 60% or 75% of the people were not wearing masks. Yeah. You know, I guess they got so tired and it was so hot that some of them actually took off their masks for long periods of time, correct?
Yeah, and nobody, I mean, That's a really tough deal. So in my situation, every picture that was ever taken of me there, you could see I had a respirator hanging around the back of my neck or hanging down on my chest. But I had a dog that needed verbal commands to, you know, have him perform his job. And the particular breed of dog that I had was a dog that basically watches your eyes and your mouth, and they try to think three steps ahead of you. So I could never wear a respirator while I was there. There were some people that just had the regular COVID kind of paper mask on. There were people that were wearing respirators, but it was extremely humid. There was many days where it was very hot. It was very difficult to get physical and be pulling stuff out, you know, and stuff like that. But it was an individual thing when it came to wearing respirators. And I do suffer the consequences of that circumstance today. So it's something that nobody really had their mind set on, that this was something that we had to do, because we had rain as well. And so the dust situation might not have been so bad one day, but there was still a massive fire burning and smoke and chemical smell just pouring out of the pile. So there was a lot of different circumstances where a respirator could have, should have, might have been worn, but it was an individual situation that kind of dictated that.
So, you know, another question is, and it's a couple of questions in one, just because I love to hear you talk, and I'm just so grateful. And once again, thank you so much. How long did you stay in New York City? And what was it like when they told you, all right, it's time to go home? And were you a different person when you drove home than the person you were when you drove there?
Yeah, I was there more than a month, and it every single day from the time I got there, things became a little more organized. There was more command centers. There was more organized food distribution, supplies, all that type of thing was progressively by the day getting more organized and organized and organized. There were very well-known situations where people in charge were trying to declare it no longer a rescue effort, but a recovery effort. There was a lot of chest pounding. There was a lot of stuff going on. Emotions were running high everywhere. Nobody wanted to give up and believe that everybody that was alive, you know, had not been found in those types of situations. So, it's just the way a mass casualty incident, but this one obviously on Pearl Harbor level mass casualty. I mean, it's not like a bus went off the road. I mean, there was 2,977 people, and the reports leading up to the building collapses was 50,000, 60,000, 70,000. Nobody knew how many people got out of the buildings. Nobody knew. So it was very, very difficult to separate the emotional part of it from rescue and recovery. I did a pretty good stretch down there.
So now when they told you it's time to go home and you hopped in your vehicle, what was that long drive home like mentally?
Well, a lot of reflection. I was also, you know, on the heels of leaving New York City, there were some ugly things going on back home. We'll just call it professional jealousy or agency jealousy. I was there as a private dog handler, a private individual. And so I was coming home to some people that were actually already targeting me and coming after me because they didn't think I had a right to be there type of deal. We had just experienced, you know, weeks and weeks and weeks of some of the most horrific things I've ever seen in my life. So it was bittersweet coming home. It was a relief coming home, because I had done everything that I could possibly do at that point. And day by day, politics became a bigger umbrella and a bigger dark shadow over Ground Zero. So I think I was actually relieved that I was gone. And the official end of it wasn't, it came well after I had left. But at that point, we had reached the boundary of what we were capable of providing as far as our skill set.
So then now we're going to kind of bring us up a little bit into, you know, what you're doing now, why you got involved with it, and tell us some of the statistics that people don't even realize. Now, like I live in, like I said, I live in North Arlington, and the cemetery is right by our house. And there's a 9/11 part of the cemetery. Mm-hmm. And almost every day you hear bagpipes playing. So, and we know that there's people dying every day because of 9/11 syndrome, like they, you know, even the Gulf War syndrome, you know, same thing with 9/11. So talk to us about that, things that people probably don't even think of.
Well, one of our mottos that's branded into our foundation is 9/11 didn't end in 2001. And a lot of what people don't realize is that 20 years down the road, 9/11 is still taking lives every week, sometimes every day. I have a daily email that comes to me that chronicles 9/11 related deaths. So the World Trade Center Health Program was created with incredible work from guys like John Feel, Feel Good Foundation, and a lot of other great people that were associated with him to get the World Trade Center Health Program established and the Victims Compensation Fund established for people that were obviously immediately impacted and affected by 9/11. In the program, there's over 100,000 people currently under treatment for toxic exposure and 9/11 related illnesses that are certified and proven to have been direct links to long-term exposure, and even immediate short-term exposure from the heaviest stuff, you know, in the hours preceding 9/11. And the cleanup effort that went on. I mean, they were still finding human remains on ledges of buildings years later. So, the types of things that affected people are still affecting them 20 years later. Since 9/11, over 3,000 more first responders and people involved directly with 9/11 have died of 9/11 related illnesses. I'm going through cancer treatment. They're just now actually certifying the lung conditions that I have. 10,000 of those 100,000 people are actually diagnosed with 9/11 related cancers. And these are all cancer clusters that don't fit the norm or are way outside of the scope of any other type of long-term studies that have ever been done. So it's important that people understand that these things are still happening. There's lots of incredible foundations, the Siller Foundation, the Feel Good Foundation, Tuesday's Children, 9/11 Families. There's tons of them out there that do incredible work for the people directly affected, the victims' families, first responders, the citizens of New York that were affected by this. So, it's important that people understand and realize that this is going on. And that's one of the reasons that I actually started the foundation that I'm the CEO of currently. And it was over this 20-year period that I actually was traveling across the United States, and I've been invited to speak and talk to people about not only service dogs, but about my time at Ground Zero, just as we're talking about it now. And I always asked the audience, would you ever go to any of the national memorials that were created for 9/11 if you had the chance to? And usually 90% of everybody said no, unless I'm going to Times Square or something like that, we're never going to go to New York to see the 9/11 museum, or we're never going to go to the Pentagon or that type of deal. So that became the catalyst of, we're going to be approaching the 20th anniversary. And something needed to be done. And so I started my foundation, which is 9/11 Remember, the Traveling Memorial Exhibit. And we have designed a traveling exhibition that is a incredible replica of the 9/11 Museum and Memorial, so that this can travel across the United States. And it's going to go to every single 9/11 memorial that was ever made with the steel beams or artifacts from the World Trade Center. There's estimated to be over 1,000. The number is fluctuated between that and 1,400. But our goal is to take this traveling exhibition at no cost to any city and visit every single one of these 9/11 memorials and continue to tell this story, so that people will understand that 9/11 is still killing people and destroying lives and families to this day. It's extremely important that in this culture, this cancel culture of tearing down statues and defacing memorials and doing all of this crap that's going on right now, that they're never going to get somebody like me to not remember people who we've lost in our lives. Because if we're not the ones that are able to tell everybody what we knew about these people and their lives before we lost them, then we'll never have that opportunity again. So that's why the work that we're doing right now is so important. And it's been very difficult. COVID basically threw a massive wall up in front of our effort to complete the construction of what we're working on, but we haven't quit. That's one of the reasons why the podcast was created, so that we can continue traveling right now and going to all these places, which we've been doing for many months now. But that's the work that we are engaged in right now.
Now, what's the name of the podcast and where is it available?
So the podcast is on Spotify, Stitcher, and iHeart right now. The best way to get linked up with it is to go to our website, which is 911travelingmemorial.org, and just click on the podcast link and it'll take you to the platforms, and then you could join or, you know, create an account. They're all free. So you can go in and listen to the podcasts that we're just now releasing. It's a very new thing. This is all new territory for me. So I don't have all of your experience, but we spent several months down in Florida starting in July, did some incredible interviews. We have some great things coming. We have some incredible podcasts coming up. But we're very, very fortunate to be working with incredible people like Daryl Worley with the Daryl Worley Foundation. He's got the song Have You Forgotten, which is a massive hit. We have been working closely with him and other veterans organizations, because not only did 9/11 cost lives on that day and the 20 years since, but we lost thousands and thousands of military service members linked into wars and things associated with 9/11 and that day forward. And that's part of us honoring those military service members as well. So we're not just the first responder centric foundation, even though, you know, my direct links are 9/11. The story goes way, way beyond just that. And so we intend to make sure that nobody is forgotten in this project that we've started, and we'll continue to work on despite the hurdles and the hill that we're still climbing. We're gonna finish this.
So, you know, in your experience, you know, things are different when you can see, you know, when you can touch. Like for us in North Arlington, there's a little space and they have one of the beams that were in the World Trade Center. It's different when you can feel it, when you can touch it. What are some of the reactions you're getting from the people that are, you know, what you're doing, when they can actually feel, when they can actually touch, and they get their audio senses around things? It kind of changes things for people, doesn't it?
Well, one thing that that we experience every single day is, no matter where we go, and we have a beautifully wrapped tour bus with the podcast on it. And then we have another a support vehicle that's wrapped with our foundation graphics. And everybody that sees that, they come to you like bees to honey, and they have a story to tell you about 9/11. And they tell you, you know, where they were that day. They could tell I had 3 eggs going, 2 pieces of bacon, my toast was slightly burnt on one side of me, and they know the details, down to the intimate details of where they were that day. And those are the types of things that we are looking forward to capturing and recording and archiving these anecdotal stories into the 9/11 Museum. You know, and they already do stuff like this at the museum, and they've had opportunities to travel across the United States and do this. But we're doing it on a different level now, because we're in every single corner of America. We're going to every single place. Every state has memorials, but we've been invited to more places than just where these memorials exist. There might be cities that have a firefighter's memorial or a fallen police officer's memorial or just a veteran's memorial. If you go to our website and just quickly fill out the online form to invite us to your city, you're automatically, logistically in the roadmap of where we will take this exhibition when it's finally completed. The devastating effects and the lockdowns and everything of COVID have severely affected our ability to complete the project. But it's always been going on in the background. And like I said, we're going to finish this and we're going to get across the finish line. But you know, we have a situation where to this day, we have people that want to come out and talk about this and continue the remembrances, tell us about their family members. So just like, one of the reasons why I believe this is virtually guided by the hand of God, so to speak. You know, 20 years later, I'm in Florida and I'm staying overnight in a city in Florida, and a person that had invited us there had gone to our website and asked us to come down and visit their town for no particular reason except just to meet us. But during that particular meeting, I was introduced to a 9/11 widow. She's in one of our podcasts. And in the interview with this woman, she describes her husband's final moments as she knows them. And she describes that horrible day for her and her unborn daughter at the time. And so during this podcast interview with this person that I never expected to meet, never heard of in my entire life, 20 years later, something was revealed in that conversation. And what was revealed was that another person that I have become friends with, who was very involved with the fire department and Rudy Giuliani at Ground Zero, just happened to be the very last person that ever was in contact with this woman's husband. And it was only the coincidence of this podcast that these two people are eventually actually going to meet and talk and find out the rest of the story of her husband's final moments. And that never would have happened unless we had done this project, this meeting of her and myself, and me knowing something that she didn't know, and her telling me a story that I had never heard. Just was like two trains on a track. It was unbelievable. That's why this has to go on. This is why we have to continue this remembrance, because it now has not been the first time that it's happened. It's happened numerous times now. And we just keep going. We're just going to keep telling these stories, because there's millions of these stories out there from that day.
Now, we have a lot of first responders that are going to be listening to this, military personnel, and a lot of us deal with grief. A lot of us deal with survivor's guilt. Mm-hmm. So what are some things that, if a person's listening to this, what are some steps that a person can do if they're dealing with, you know, survivor's guilt or still dealing with grief? What are some things that you've seen over the years that have helped you or others?
Well, the first and foremost thing is everybody should at least know that what they're experiencing, what they're feeling is real. It's not what somebody else tells you it is or is not. You lived it. You experienced it. What goes on within yourself and how it's handled from that moment on is hugely important on how you will get through the situation or not. And thank God the resources are getting better every day, and the amount of organizations and people out there for this type of thing are available in much better numbers than they were 20 years ago. The other thing that you have to remember and realize is that stigma kills. And if you allow the stigma of what you think people are going to look at you like, if you say you have a problem, you have to get that out of your mind. Because it's going to be one of the things that saves your life if things are really that bad. And like I said, I was not a massive believer in PTSD when I was at Ground Zero. I didn't believe, I mean, I knew people that I had worked with that had some pretty rough moments or some rough experiences, but I never saw firsthand, you know, somebody that was dealing with PTSD that I was completely convinced was something that could wreck a life or wreak such havoc on somebody's personal ability to function, you know. And it's like, I guess the greatest description would be, you know, people are called functioning alcoholics, people can go to work and you would never know that you're a stark raving drunk, you know, and just a terrible, you know, this or that. But that's what goes on with PTSD and suicide. You go out and try to work and be, you know, a regular part of society like you were before something broke inside. I can guarantee you everybody can break. Every single person can break in some way, shape, or form. And so the importance of realizing that and not letting some of these hurdles, you know, they could be small hurdles or they could be mountain-sized hurdles, but you have to be able to help get those mountains down to molehills, so to speak, and understand that a single phone call can get you more help than you ever imagined that you could ever get. And on the outside of our bus and on our website, you can find places to go for help. Many incredible organizations and foundations out there that will come to you, that will provide services in your area. And that's one of the things that we're providing in the traveling exhibition, which is 4 full-size semi-trucks, 53 feet long, double wide expandable, 1200 square foot each. One half of one of those trailers is dedicated directly to this type of deal. Wherever we pull up with this exhibition, anybody, firefighter, veteran, police officer, ambulance driver, tow truck driver, doesn't matter, regular person on the street, if you're having trouble or if you're struggling, you can go to a computer database that we will have that will allow you to be put directly in touch with the people that you need to talk to, the people that are waiting for you to give them a call. And so those are the types of things that will be an integral part of the work that we do throughout this project.
So obviously it's all cost money. Like us, we got to keep the lights on. You have to, you know, do these things. So how can we support your mission? How can we support you in your endeavor and whatever you're doing? How can we support you for what you're doing?
So I really appreciate you bringing this up. And this has been a huge learning curve for us. I've never run a 501c3 before. One of the things that was part of getting this organization started was you end up with 20 full-time jobs, even though you think you're at one full-time job. There's 20 individual full-time jobs. It's fundraising. It's doing the taxes. It's telling the story. It's getting all the creative work done to get these things organized and get the building started and whatnot. So we have actually funded this personally. We've never taken any type of, you know, aside from a person getting a challenge coin and handing us $20 or something like that, we've never campaigned for public money, even though we're a 501c3. And we're converting out of that stage right now. So anybody can go to our website and they could become a partner. They can become a corporate partner or sponsor. You can become a sponsor of the podcast, just like you have your sponsors that you announce every time. We are 100% open to anybody reaching out to us that wants to help us carry this mission forward and help us be able to tell these stories, to help us get people that you might know in touch with the services and the things that, that we've just talked about. So being a 501c3, obviously any contributions can be written off, you know, as a tax write-off, and you can follow those rules, you know, per state or where you're from. But we definitely need public involvement with us now, because we've actually exhausted the amount of economic help that we can actually give to our own foundation at this point. And if we proceed any further without public input, we could lose our status as a 501c3, which is a devastating thing to happen, because we are a group of people that nobody takes a salary. Nobody's ever made a penny doing what we do. We've exhausted our own personal finances to get us to the point that we're at right now. So we welcome everybody with open arms. 911travelingmemorial.org. That will just give you an incredible website to go through, find out history, find out statistics, facts. All the things that we've been talking about in this conversation are available on that website. Places to donate to, places to contact us, where we will get directly back to you. I make 99% of the calls personally, and we get contacted by thousands of people, and I speak to every one of them personally. So we're grateful to hear from you, and we'd be even more grateful if you found a way to contribute to us.
Well, we're definitely going to push it out everywhere. I just want to say thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you for coming on and telling your story. And I'm going to start a prayer chain for you also for your health, because, you know, a lot of people realize that, you know, we're trying, you know, we're trying to be strong for everybody else. And sometimes it's when we're at our weakest that we're trying to be stronger for everybody else. So definitely going to pray for you. I want to thank you guys for watching. You know, you guys, without you, this show wouldn't be what it is. If this touched you the way it touched me, please leave a comment on, because this is going to go out on LinkedIn. It's going to go out everywhere, and it'll go out on the podcast in about 6 weeks. So please leave a comment, and I'll definitely shoot the comments over to Eric. So guys, if this touched you as much as you do, please go to the website. Even if you just can make a one-time donation, just something to help Eric help save lives. Brother, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Richard. It's been an honor to speak with you. I know we're going to be great friends from today forward. We have a lot of mutual things that we're impassioned to let other people know about. And hopefully this is a very long and fruitful relationship.
And what was the name of the podcast again?
The podcast is 9/11 Remembered, in quotes, Let's Roll podcast tour. And Let's Roll obviously is referencing that incredible man, Todd Beamer, who put up a heroic fight to make sure that more people weren't taken from us that horrible day in 2001. And so we travel the United States honoring him. They're great rally words to use for everything that we do going forward. And we are blessed every day to be able to say that.
So guys, make sure you go check them out. You said it's on Spotify, it's on iHeart. Make sure you check them out. Make sure you subscribe. Make sure you leave a comment. Let them know that they're changing lives. All right, guys.
Three links on the website that take you to the platforms.
Awesome. Have an amazing week, guys. Vertical momentum. The only way to go is but up. All right, brother. Eric, have an amazing week, brother.
You as well. Take care.
Hey, guys. If you're enjoying our show. If you love what we're doing, if you would like to support us, we have a whole bunch of great stuff coming out. We have a brand new t-shirt line that's coming out. Hats, coffee mugs, any kind of swag that lets your friends know that you support Vertical Momentum and you're always looking to get better. Also, we have our new coffee brand coming out. It's called Vertical Momentum Coffee. It's ass-kicking coffee. And it will get you moving in the morning. So guys, if you're interested, go to www.richardkaufman.net. Check us out. Leave us a note. Tell us what you'd like, and we'll actually send it to you. The new website is being built. So if you guys want to, our book is out there on Amazon. It's called A Hero's Journey from Darkness to Light. Definitely check it out. It talks about my story, but it also talks about how to survive depression, how to survive addiction. All right, guys, I love you. Thank you so much for always supporting our mission, which is to save lives.
Thank you for joining us today. Please hit subscribe and share. Please feel free to leave us a comment.